Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to RBG Beyond Notorious. This is the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the CNN film RBG.
People ask me, don't you feel uncomfortable being with a name like the Notorious B.I.G.? Why should I feel uncomfortable? We have a lot in common.
We're going to take you on a decade-by-decade journey through the life of Supreme Court Justice and pop icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Stories you've never heard before from the people who know her the best.
On the Law Review, Ruth was treated with reverence because we knew how good she was.
Her advice to me is very much the same advice that her mother gave to her, which is be fiercely independent, but also, quote, be a lady.
The experience of being a Ginsburg clerk was just that you tried to work as hard as she did and tried to live up to her very high ambitions for the quality of the work that got done.
I'm Poppy Harlow, and I'm joined throughout this journey by CNN's chief legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin. Thanks for being here.
Hiya, Poppy.
Hi. I always see you on the tube on the TV, and now you're here.
It's like just my voice.
In the fancy podcast studio. I'm psyched about this, and let's just begin with how it is nearly impossible to overstate the importance and how unusual it is that an 85-year-old Supreme Court justice has truly become a pop icon.
Well, you know, I've spent much of my career covering the Supreme Court, and one of the things I've always noted with some sadness is that, like, people don't know who the justices are. They're sort of aware right. of the Supreme Court as this important thing.
Right.
But, you know, the justices themselves are really obscure. But in the last few years, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has emerged as an icon, that well transcends the justice Ginsburg, as this heroine of the feminist movement, of the civil rights revolution, and of the Supreme Court. You know, we're going to be talking as we move along why that is.
Yeah.
But it is an extraordinary phenomenon. And the fact that she is 85 years old
right.
makes it even more extraordinary, but also contributes to why she's so famous. And you
yes.
had the opportunity to interview her.
I did.
At a sort of key moment in your own life as well.
As in a no sleep moment 5 days after having my second child. Yes, that's true. I mean, this is, you know, I never thought I would have the opportunity because few do. I mean, you have, but mm-hmm. few get to interview sitting Supreme Court justices. And my alma mater, Columbia University, came to me and said, we have a women's conference and RBG is going to be a guest. Would you do the interview? So here I am 3 months pregnant. And the interview was actually slated on my due date. And I thought, no way, my husband will kill me. I cannot say yes to this when I'm supposed to be in labor. So my due date gets moved up a week. I ask him what he thinks, and he's like, you can't miss this interview. But initially, I said no to Columbia. I was so worried about, you know, being in labor at the same time. And they said, are you really saying no to a sitting Supreme Court justice? You should do this interview.
Well, and we were talking about this in the lead up, and
right.
you really didn't know.
I really didn't know if I'd be able to do it.
But I think, you know, it's a cute story.
Sure.
But it is also a revealing story about women in the workplace.
It is.
And who better to be interviewing under those circumstances?
I appreciate that. And hats off to you who helped me a lot. And Joan Biskupic will be on the podcast for preparing and Ariane DeVogue for the interview. But I prepared about a month in advance thinking if this baby comes early, I better be ready for this interview. But the truth is, it's an interview that I knew I would tell my daughter and my son, who I was giving birth to, about years later because of the huge role that she played in laying the foundations of equality for women like me. I mean, because of what she has written, what she has done, has opened the door to so much for so many women and so many working mothers. So that was a fascinating interview. You'll hear some of it in a moment. But just talking about her, she's a Brooklyn girl, Jeff.
She is. And, you know, she is one of the very few Supreme Court justices who would have a major place in American legal history if she had never served on the Supreme Court. I mean, sure, she is in the Thurgood Marshall of women's rights.
Although she doesn't like being called that.
She doesn't like being called that out of modesty because
yep.
she recognizes correctly that Thurgood Marshall literally his life was on the line at every moment when he was blazing the trail for
civil rights.
And RBG is very careful to say she was never in physical danger, but in terms of changing the law, her impact was comparable to that, her impact on women's rights. And so, one of the amazing things about Ginsburg is that she was almost 60 years old by the time she was appointed to the D.C. Circuit.
Right.
So she had a long, serious career before she became any kind of judge. Mm-hmm. And she was on the D.C. Circuit for a number of years before Bill Clinton appointed her to the Supreme Court in 1993. And that, of course, set her on a very new, different trajectory. So much about her life is cinematic, and it's no wonder that they are making movies about her now, not just our documentary, but like actual
feature films. This is how the interview that I did with Ruth Bader Ginsburg opened. Listen.
In your first argument as an attorney before the court, you quoted the feminist, the attorney, the abolitionist, Sarah Grimke, who said in 1837, "I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they
take their feet off our necks." It had a certain shock quality, which is what I attended. I wanted to get the attention.
Are their feet off our necks today?
Much more so than I ever dreamed would be possible in my growing up years.
So, Jeffrey, talk about her importance on the court today.
Well, I mean, this is part of the story that I think it's important to be honest about. Her importance on the court is less than it might be because she's often in the minority. She is a progressive. She's a Democrat. She's a liberal. And there is a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. And you know, as we are speaking here, it looks like that conservative majority is going to be added to.
Yeah, with Kavanaugh.
Because Anthony Kennedy stepped down at the end of this term. And, Kennedy was a quirky figure in many respects, but certainly on issues that mattered a great deal, that matter a great deal to Ruth Ginsburg, he was on her side, and most notably abortion rights. And, many, not all, but many of RBG's opinions, most important opinions, have been dissents. That hasn't been true for all of them. I mean, but it is an important, that like Thurgood Marshall before her, she has been a person who has not been with the dominant faction on
right.
the Supreme Court.
So in this podcast, we are taking our listeners on this decade-by-decade journey through her life, through the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We're going to talk to the people who knew her and know her best. Hopefully, you're going to get a little bit of a better understanding of how maybe she changed your life. She did things that definitely changed your life. So let's start with the present and let's look at RBG in the era of Trump.
Well, she is not a person of the Trump era. She is a person of a very different era, politically, socially, temperamentally.
Right.
In perhaps ways that she might regret, and we'll be talking about this a little later. She made it clear that she was not, she was not fond of President Trump. But, President Trump is not the whole country either. It's important to remember that.
Right.
And one reason I think RBG is so popular now is that she has this enormously important platform
where
she is fully capable and fully engaged and fully outraged at a lot of what's going on in the country and is not pulling any punches. And that view is held by a lot of people in this country as well. Just doesn't happen to be held by the president of the United States.
There you go. So up first with us, we're going to talk to someone who knows RBG better than almost anyone. She calls her Bubby. We will call her Clara Spera, and she is RBG's granddaughter, currently a clerk for the U.S. District Court in New York. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, you're a star in this CNN film. And a big part of your grandmother's life. And of course, you've in many ways followed in her footsteps. You went to Harvard Law, like she did. And when she was there, she was one of nine women in her class at Harvard Law. And she was stunningly, even for that time, asked to defend and explain why she should hold a seat that a man would have. Remember her telling you about that?
Yeah, I mean, that story is, I think, well known and very different to my experience. On my first day at Harvard Law, the then dean of the law school, Martha Minow, a woman, introduced the class and celebrated the fact that my class, the graduating class of 2017, was the first class at Harvard Law School that had full gender parity, 50% men, 50% women. And it was a cause for celebration, but I think also somewhat of a cause for shock that it was only in the class of 2017 that women matched the number of men.
Yeah.
Did you know when you were before you got to law school how important your grandmother was? I mean, you know, you just so to fill people in, your mother is a distinguished professor at Columbia Law School. Your father's a successful lawyer. So you grew up in this world. But did it? What did you learn about your grandmother in law school at something of a distance?
I always knew that she was very important, but I think I didn't understand the intricacies of the kind of work that she did both on the court and when she was practicing law. And in law school, I really garnered a real appreciation for what it was that she did in terms of the actual changes in the law that she has moved along throughout her career. It's also interesting because when I was right about when I started law school, it was my time in law school dovetailed perfectly with the explosion of her public profile.
Yeah.
And so had I gone to law school 5 years earlier, I might not have been walking down the hallway greeted with by people wearing T-shirts with her face on it or quotes of hers on tote bags.
Or did your different last names help you sort of conceal, you know?
Sure. I definitely attempted to stay under the radar. It was not a relationship that I advertised widely. The fact that we don't share a last name helps in that regard. Certainly in the first year curriculum, we read a lot of her opinions, especially in our civil procedure class. So that was one thing I learned about her is that she's kind of a procedure nut.
You know, can I just interrupt? I mean, this is one of the great sort of weird things about Ruth Ginsburg is that, you know, everybody knows her as, you know, this feminist pioneer, but she's really into civil procedure. And in fact, one of the truly bizarre chapters in her life is that she spent a year studying Swedish civil procedure.
Mm-hmm. They over there.
In Sweden.
Yeah. She learned Swedish.
Of course, as one does.
Yeah, as one does. But I mean, you know, this is not, shall we say, a sexy part of the law in any sense of the word. But, you know, she's really good at it. And she it's a way of her extending her influence independent of sort of the political world that you know, is so involved in the women's rights movement.
It is, but I also think that procedure complements the fight for equality. Because
how so?
If you look at some of the opinions that she's written or dissents, you just mentioned the Lilly Ledbetter case, which I know you'll get to in another episode, that was ultimately a procedural question, when someone could bring a claim for pay discrimination. And it was all about whether or not discrimination could be told, as in the events of discrimination added up one after the other, or each
time a lesser paycheck came through.
Exactly.
Told, T-O-L-L-E-D, not T-O-L-D,
right? Yes.
Told, right.
Exactly.
That case was about statutes of limitations and when you could bring a case.
She taught you, Clara, how to win an argument and what not to do to win.
That is true, but she gave me advice which I am embarrassed to say I often ignored until recently. But, you know, I think that you see both through her writing and through her very public friendships that she does not yell. She doesn't go overboard. And she really tries to be a consensus builder when that's possible. And so her advice to me is very much the same advice that her mother gave to her, which is be fiercely independent, but also, quote, be a lady. So don't let your anger get the better of you. You can't win an argument by yelling. Now, I was a competitive debater in high school and college, and sometimes I ignored that advice. And more often than not, I lost when I wasn't taking that advice into account. But I think that is really a product of how she was raised and how she approaches the court and the law. I think there are others who say that now especially is a time to fight. Now is a time to, you know, not build consensus, but really ignore or not bring those on board who aren't fully on board. And I think there is value to that argument.
Well, what do you think, and also what does your grandmother think? I mean, you know, yeah, she was a courtroom lawyer, mm-hmm. and that was her contribution. What about the women who were in the streets? Did she feel that they were complimentary, contradictory? I mean, what was her attitude towards the people who took other routes?
Well, I can't say how she felt or what her attitude at the time was. I can only imagine that she thinks that more people fighting for rights and equality through different avenues is probably a good thing. But growth in social movements, unless reflected in the law and vice versa, can't achieve much. And the law often has to catch up with social movements more so than social movements catching up with the law. One of her former clerks and a professor of mine, Professor Klarman of Harvard Law School, has written at great length about this. And he was inspired by his time working for my grandmother. Mm-hmm. The idea that we often have to wait for social movements to define the, you know, social zeitgeist, and then the law can respond. And if the law tries to move too quickly before social movements have caught up, often there is backlash. And you see that in the argument that my grandmother has often raised with respect to Roe v. Wade.
I was just going to say that's what she said, which surprises many people because they know where she stands on reproductive rights. And we'll get to that in a future episode. But I did ask her in the interview. You were there in the audience.
I was.
I asked her about the Me Too movement. Here's what she told me.
It's amazing to me that for the first time, women are really listened to, because sexual harassment had often been dismissed as, well, she made it up, or she's too thin-skinned. So I think it's a very healthy development.
Can I just interject one thing? Did you notice that long pause in the middle of the answer?
Classic.
That is classic. That is classic.
I think it
unnerves anyone she encounters, whether it's an interviewer or even a family member at the dinner table.
She does that?
Yes. And she's thinking so deeply, and much more deeply than the three of us combined, I'd imagine. And she's just not. And I think this speaks to what we were just talking about. She will often not speak unless she knows it is the right thing to say, the perfectly developed argument or the perfectly developed idea. And she, unlike me, doesn't waste words and just fills space. And she has gotten to a point, I think, in her career and in public appreciation of her, is that she knows people will wait for her to finish that sentence or finish that thought.
You know, when I've been reporting about RBG, I have interviewed a lot of law clerks and whatnot, and several of them talk about the experience going in for a clerkship interview, which is you know, unnerving in the best of circumstances, and they come to these pauses, and they said, you know, they almost universally said, I just started babbling like an idiot because I couldn't stop. And I remember once when I was interviewing her, I was very proud of the fact that there was one of these pauses, and I let it sit there and I let it sit there. And finally, Justice Ginsburg said to me, you know, I finished my answer.
You
go ahead and ask me something else. But I thought, you know, RBG, I outlasted you.
Yeah, you were eternally patient. No, I had heard, I don't know if it's sort of just an urban myth, but that her clerks and some of them have the like three Mississippi rule, that they count one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi before they jump in. You know, we talked a little bit also about, you know, an Equal Rights Amendment, mm-hmm. which did not, you know, get enough of the states on board to be ratified, mm-hmm. and which we still don't have. So mm-hmm. we still technically, we talked about, not, you know, not having equal protection for women under the Constitution in the form of an Equal Rights Amendment. What do you think, or has she talked to you about what she sees as full equality for women in America? When we will reach that day, or what that day would look like?
We haven't, you know, had that precise conversation. But I think that throughout our conversations and just knowing her, there are a few indications of what she might think. And actually going back to your interview, Poppy, with her, when you asked her, are there feet off our necks? And she said, much more so than I could have ever imagined. But she didn't say they're off completely.
No.
So the first thing we know is that we're not there yet. In part because of that answer, in part because we don't have an Equal Rights Amendment. But I also think that her appreciation for the Me Too movement signals that she understands that there are generational shifts when it comes to seeking certain rights and equality. And what she may have been fighting for in the 70s, actual black and white discrimination written into laws on paper, while there may be less of that type of gender-based discrimination now, there are perhaps similarly insidious types of discrimination, but that appear in different ways, and that the fight is probably truly never over. And we see that not just in the case of gender equality, but also racial equality mm-hmm. and the other types of discrimination that many people in this country face.
Can I ask you both, and Jeffrey, to you first, when the history books are written about Justice Ginsburg, what will they say? What is the one most important thing they will say?
They'll start with her career as a lawyer. I mean, I think there's it is so hard to imagine how discriminatory all laws were against women when RBG started practicing law. You know, women couldn't get credit cards in their own names. They couldn't get real estate on their own without their husbands. I mean, there was no such thing as marital rape. I mean, just the mm-hmm. laws were just unrecognizable from today. And it was because of her architecture of fighting these yeah. laws that those laws on the books have changed. And I think, you know, her legacy as a justice will be principally as a dissenter. I think she will be seen as a woman who
the great dissenter
who was not right, who was not in the majority, at least mm-hmm. in all of the great cases of her tenure.
And to your point, we're going to, in another episode, have Arthur Miller on, her friend, who says she knit a sweater. Her strategy through being a lawyer was sort of knitting a sweater and step by step by step getting to these. Clara, what will they write?
Just a note on the Professor Miller metaphor. While I appreciate it, I wish he had picked something a little less gendered than knitting.
Oh, there you go. How could I miss that?
I see his point and I do agree with it.
So what will the – did she even knit? I mean,
no.
Come on. what will the book say about your grandmother, the history books?
You know, one would hope that depending when the book is written, maybe a few decades from now, it will be that her dissents were adopted as – a majority opinions eventually and into law, like some of her past dissents. So, you know, she never went on the court wanting to be the great dissenter. I don't think anybody does, frankly. So it's hard to say. But I think that that's right, that her career as a litigator will be what is highlighted, but that how she was able to bring a lot of those values into her tenure as a Supreme Court justice. And of course, I don't think any book would be fully complete without mention of her exceptional sense of style.
The dissent collars.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, and not just the dissent collars. She's like a very fashionable woman off the bench as well.
I raid her closet every time I visit.
There you go.
Well, you should.
Clara, thank you.
Thank you
really
so much.
It's been a delight and eye-opening. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Stick around. We have CNN's Supreme Court guru, Joan Piskupic, here with us to help us understand RBG's role in the Trump era.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
All right. With us now is Joan Piskupic, our Supreme Court guru at CNN. She truly knows everything about the High Court, and she's here to talk to us about a lot. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the importance of RBG in what the court very well may look like next term if Justice Kavanaugh is confirmed.
Her role, she will be starting a whole new era herself. She will only be more important as the leader of the liberal wing with very little chance to move anybody over to their side. Anthony Kennedy was as good as it got for the justices on the left. The man who will be in the middle now, John Roberts, is nothing like that kind of a swing justice. If she ever manages to pull him over to the side of the four liberals, it will be a much different kind of ruling, much further to the right. She herself is going to have to figure out how to bring more unity to the four liberals. She once told me that she hated how messy the dissent was in Bush v. Gore when they all wrote separately. And she has wanted to have the four on the left speak with one voice. That was very difficult, even in the era of Anthony Kennedy. She could count on Sonia Sotomayor to speak with her in the more liberal vein. But Justices Breyer and Kagan have broken off a lot because they're much more moderate. She's going to have real tension in terms of trying to keep her people together to be the voice of liberalism on the high court, but yet to try to win also. So there's going to be compromise. She will be walking a much finer line where she will have to decide who she is. Will she be the great dissenter who speaks only out there, or does she try to work with what she's got, a very different individual in John Roberts than Anthony Kennedy?
Well, and to Jeffrey, do you remember when she said, someone asked her at some forum, who should eat more the most kale on the court right now? And she said Anthony Kennedy.
Well, sure. That he was the lifeline on abortion rights, on some civil rights cases, on the death penalty. And he's gone now, and presumably Kavanaugh will replace him. Kavanaugh was chosen not to be Anthony Kennedy. He was chosen to be much closer to Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas. But Joan, I just wanted to ask you, in addition to keeping the liberals together, like, what do you think it's going to be like to lose all the time for her?
She will be wearing that dissenting collar all the time. She is used to being...
Well, say what the descending collar is.
Oh, really, it's actually a physical collar.
It is. She always, because she is so stylish, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Jeff, because she has a great sense of style under that black robe.
Oh, yeah.
But what she puts over the black robe on occasion are very colorful, intricate collars. And on the days that she's going to read a descent from the bench, she has this one that has, it's black with silver crystal accents that she likes to wear. So we always know, like, what's coming. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I've kidded that she it's her way of taking off the gloves and putting on the collar. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been in a position to be demoralized over time and rise above it. And she will be very much challenged at this moment because, in the last, I would say, let's just take the last 8 years, she was able to eke out many victories, especially on social policy, abortion rights, gay rights.
I left out gay rights.
Exactly.
Which is, of course, the most dramatic area. Yeah.
It is almost impossible to see her winning on social dilemmas with the court as it will be constituted. And I think you're right that she will have to fight this sense of being in the minority and losing. But if anyone can do it, it's someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's overcome so much.
So, Joan, I remember vividly anchoring, and you came on the show all of a sudden because you had done this stunning interview with RBG a few years ago. This is after she told the New York Times about then-candidate Trump. I can't imagine what this country would be with Donald Trump as our president. I don't even want to contemplate that. So you walk into this interview, and you think she's going to walk it back, but she doubles down and she calls him a faker to you.
What happened was, not only had the New York Times elicited that kind of response from her, but also the Associated Press.
Right.
And I had a previously scheduled appointment to talk to her about John Roberts.
For your book.
Exactly.
Yes. Can we just say that Joan has a biography of John Roberts coming out relatively soon, and everybody should read it. So just
and pre-order.
Yeah. So just I'm sure you're happy with that interruption, but please continue about your interview.
One author to another.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So I go in there, and Poppy and Jeff, I'm thinking that I can't not ask her about what she just said, but I actually expected her to walk it back.
Yeah.
And because she had already been getting some public pushback about her line about, I'm going to move to New Zealand if he's elected. So I say, do you regret this, Justice Ginsburg? And she says, no, he is a faker. He's a faker. And why haven't the media pressed him to release his tax returns? And she starts almost as if she were outlining a brief, talking about all the things that was wrong with Donald Trump as candidate. And at one point she said something that was even more derogatory, and she said, oh, that's off the record. So I knew that this was an on-the-record conversation.
Yeah.
There was just one point that she was saying that was off. And she spoke so publicly and almost proudly with her remarks, and the word faker, I think, is what resonated, Poppy.
So after that, this is mid-July 2016, before the election, President Trump tweets, Justice Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court has embarrassed us all by making very dumb political statements about me. Her mind is shot. Resign. And then in this Katie Couric interview, she does admit, Joan, she probably shouldn't have said anything like that.
What happened was she got such pushback, not just from someone like Donald Trump, who she wasn't going to listen to, but liberal friends, the editorial page of the New York Times, calling into question her judgment for saying something about an individual who could potentially come before the court. So what she says is, upon reflection, my recent remarks were ill-advised, and she didn't apologize for saying what she said about Donald Trump as faker. It was more that she realized, as a justice, she shouldn't have been making injudicious remarks.
I mean, look, let's be candid. I mean, it was outrageous what she said. She should not have said that stuff. I mean,
why do you think she did it, Jeff? Not once, twice, but three times.
You know
then?
What? I think it was weird. I don't have a good explanation for it. I think, one of the things, I don't know about this personally, but I am told that people, when they get older, they become more like themselves. And I think, she's an old-fashioned liberal, and she's, I think her internal censors are down. And I think it happened with Justice Scalia, her friend and political opposite, who became crankier and more political in his old age. And I think she's become crankier and more political in her old age. And I wish she had said it to me rather than Joan, because it was a great scoop for Joan.
CNN quickly hired Joan after that interview.
But I just think it was ridiculous and outrageous.
Well, can I add something about my experience with her? Mm-hmm. She is an honest woman. She is very honest. I thought this episode showed two things about her. First of all, she will say things. She was very honest to me about what it was like to sit around the table as the only female justice at a point where Sandra Day O'Connor had left the court and Sonia Sotomayor was not yet on the court, and how she was even ignored sometimes with these men around the conference table, these eight justices. She had always been very honest about what it was to express her views. So I think that was part of it a bit. But the other thing, Jeff, that I think she did that many other people wouldn't have done, when she realized what she had done wrong, she admitted it. And that's the other thing that I think comes with experience, that you're right, that maybe she shouldn't have said it. I, frankly, was very happy that she said it to me.
Yeah, for...
But maybe she shouldn't have said it. But then she acknowledged that she was wrong.
But the president... and that showed good judgment and sound. I noticed the same thing, too, that when she saw her traditional allies, even.
Yeah.
Including, for example, people like me. I mean, I wrote something about it that she said, you know what, better to put up the white flag and fight another battle.
She in fact, there was talk about would she have to recuse herself from certain cases that came before the court because of this, the travel ban, for example. She concurred with Justice Sotomayor in the dissent on that one. So, I mean, it didn't end up affecting her, ability to sit on the bench and do this job. But there was talk about
And also, I mean, there is a certain amount of pretense involved here, because these justices, all of them, are politically sophisticated people, all with strong political views, political connections. You don't get appointed to the United States Supreme Court without a lot of contacts in the political world. Mm-hmm. So the idea that the justices don't have these views is sort of absurd. But at the same time, I think they all recognize that there is a purpose served by not broadcasting those views. And I think Ginsburg recognized the folly of her ways on that occasion.
Finish the sentence for me, Joan. When the history books are written about RBG, the most important line will read?
She mattered to women for many, many years. And in the last chapters of her time on the Supreme Court, she mattered to everyone in terms of individual rights.
Fascinating. Joan Piskupic, thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone pre-order Joan's book. Another plug there. It will be no doubt a fascinating read on Chief Justice John Roberts. And thank you to everyone, Joan and Clara. On our next episode, we're going to focus on the 2000s and the decade that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg really cemented her reputation and gained her famous notorious nickname.
She's just such an unlikely pop cultural icon in a lot of ways. She is pretty
old.
She's 80. You can say it. Right. She's 85.
She's pretty old. Yes, that's true.
Right. I mean, older women in our society are generally not celebrated, particularly not as cool, hip, cultural figures.
Keep listening. Her story continues next. And don't forget to watch the CNN film RBG this fall.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.